Welcome to Africa Live on AhuruRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we spoke a little bit on last week following our interview with Comrade Hulisani Mbada, who is the Secretary General of the Youth Wing of the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, PICO. After we done the interview with him and spoke with him for a while, we spoke a little bit about the conference that was going on at the time, the conference that was happening in St. Petersburg, Florida, that was going on from June 21st through the 24th, which was a conference to build the African Internationalist Student Organization, a student wing of the African People's Socialist Party. It was initially our intention to play some excerpts from that conference on last week, but we realized that it just wasn't enough time, considering that we had that very important interview with Comrade Hulisani Mbada. So what we're going to do on today is play a little bit, play some stuff from that conference. What we're playing today is going to be a presentation that was made by Comrade Diop Olukbala, or excerpts from that presentation. And he presented, he did a presentation on the history of the African People's Socialist Party. Now, initially, you know, it may strike folk as unusual that we would have a presentation about the history of the African People's Socialist Party done at a conference to build a student organization, the African Internationalist Student Organization. But the reason why is because, again, AISO is being built as the student wing of the African People's Socialist Party. And so it's important to have given participants an understanding of who the African People's Socialist Party is, and what it was that they were becoming a part of. So we're going to play that, and I just want to say before we do, again, that was an incredibly significant conference. The conference to build AISO, the African Internationalist Student Organization, and will prove to be a very historic conference that will open up a whole I won't say a new front of the African liberation struggle, but will bring back this whole sector of the African community on board with the African revolutionary process, bring students back into that process, students who have been out of the process for so long, since the 1960s, in a real kind of way, have not been in that process. And so this was part of a process to you know, bring that sector of our community back into the fold, into the struggle to liberate our whole people, to change the conditions for our whole people, as opposed to, you know, what these institutions are set up to do, which is to train them to become members of the African petty bourgeoisie, to seek their future aligned with the future of imperialism, which in fact is no future at all. So having said that, again, this is the excerpts from presentation made by Comrade Diop Olukbala, who is the national organizer of national organizer for the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, and it is a presentation on the history of the African People's Socialist Party, but not just the history of the African People's Socialist Party, but the history of the African liberation struggle, because it's only in that context that you can understand the reason for the founding of the African People's Socialist Party and the significance of the African People's Socialist Party in this process. So we're going to play that. And here is the presentation by Comrade Diop Olugbala.
Uhuru. So, you know, I want to, first of all, appreciate the overview given by the Comrade Kobina. I think that he really put the significance of AISO into its proper perspective, and that it's not just a student organization, but it's an actual wing of the African People's Socialist Party. And there is no solution for African people just in the struggle to improve the conditions on the campus, or just to allow for students to participate in the struggle to improve our community, but it has to be tied to a revolutionary process. And this revolutionary process falls under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. And so this is why we have to have an understanding of what the party is, where the party has come from, some of the conditions in the world that have given rise to the creation of the African People's Socialist Party. As dialecticians, as historical materialists, we understand that nothing exists in a vacuum, and there's no process that is created by itself. And so this presentation is designed to allow us to appreciate the historical basis of the party's existence and the historical mission of the African People's Socialist Party. So I'm going to start with the period, the most recent period of significance, although it can be taken back even further in terms of the initial attack that was made on Africa by Europe, and this attack that has essentially led to the emergence of parasitic capitalism of white power. And the African Revolution as a whole is essentially the byproduct of this attack, for there would be no need for us to make a revolution if our homeland had not come under assault, if our people had not been taken into captivity, and if our resources had not been expropriated from us. So in terms of the party, we are a revolutionary party. We see ourselves as the advanced detachment of the African working class, and our primary role in the world is to organize the masses of African people, and to lead our people to revolutionary conclusions and make us aware of our selfish class interests as workers, and our national interests as African people. And the period that we're going to begin with right now is with the end of what they call, or what we refer to as, the Second Imperialist War, and what imperialism calls World War II. But the most significant thing about this period was not just necessarily the war itself, but during this period we begin to see national liberation struggles take a qualitative leap in terms of our capacity to struggle, our capacity to fight white power. And so this is the period that we're going to begin to analyze first, so we can hit the space bar thing. Yeah. So during this period, the whole world, and this figure right here, his name is Mao Zedong. He was the chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, and he was essentially the leadership of the Chinese Revolution. And he succeeded in uniting all of China and overthrowing imperialism, Japanese imperialism, and European imperialism. And now actually said that during this period, there is great disorder under the cosmos. And that disorder he was referring to was the essentially the struggle of oppressed people to reclaim our independence and our freedom. And so during this period, as we know, China achieved its liberation, fulfilled its own revolution. Kobina. Also during this period, the Cuban Revolution had won to a certain degree under the leadership of Fidel Castro and other key forces there. Also during this general period, we see the Vietnamese make a magnificent struggle for liberation, for independence from French colonialism under the leadership of Ho Chi Minh and other key forces in this area. And so, you know, these are just some examples, and there are many others of the struggles that are being made by oppressed people during this period to win our liberation. And this entire process has served to deepen a crisis that imperialism has been undergoing. And throughout this entire conference, you're going to be hearing a lot about the crisis of imperialism. We in the party believe that imperialism is suffering a deep and profound crisis, and that crisis has at its origin the struggle of oppressed people to take back our resources, to be free, because imperialism was born out of the enslavement of African people and the rest of us. And the more oppressed people begin to fight back, the deeper this crisis for imperialism becomes. And so those liberation struggles that we just reviewed are some factors that contributed to the deepening of the crisis of imperialism. And perhaps most significant or most detrimental to imperialism is the African Liberation Movement, because we also understand that it is the oppression of African people that has provided the real pedestal upon which white power rests. Notwithstanding the exploitation and oppression of the world's people in Vietnam and in Latin America and around the world, but it was the attack on Africa that allowed for white power to emerge and to gain massive amounts of wealth and political power for itself. So the African Liberation Movement plays a key role in the destruction, must play a key role in the destruction of white power. And during this period as well, we begin to see the African Liberation Movement reach new levels of struggle. And so, go ahead, bro. So some of these struggles existed on various fronts, many of which were on the continent itself, some of these fronts were in other parts of the world, including the U.S., and we're going to talk more about how that looked. But just a few examples. We see here Mozambique, and this figure here, his name is Samora Michelle, who was the leader of Frelimo, which was one of the most progressive organizational forces on the ground in the Mozambique front of the African Revolution. We also had a struggle going on in Angola, where there were at least three different organizations on the ground, in some junctures contending for leadership of the Angola front of the revolution. I believe that the most progressive of them came in the form of MPLA under the leadership of Agostinho Neto, and part of the reason being that he had more of an internationalist approach during this struggle, MPLA benefited from the deployment of Cuban revolutionaries, Cuban forces who came to this assistance to the aid of Africans and the MPLA in this period. And there were other factors involved in that, including the intervention of the Soviet Union. But the main point is that we see an internationalist type of character to the struggle being made on the Angola front. And that's important for us to review in future aspects of this presentation. We also, during this period, saw the liberation struggle going on the Kenya front, probably one of the most dynamic and well-known fronts of our struggle. We see on the left, brother by the name of Jomo Kenyatta, who was nicknamed the Burning Spear, who was the first president of nominally independent Kenya. But Kenyatta was significant for a lot of reasons, but especially for his support and unity that he showed with the Mau Mau. And we see the leadership of the Mau Mau on the right, this brother's name. This is one of the only pictures that exist, I believe, of Dedan Kimathi, who was the leader of the Mau Mau Freedom Land Party, which led an armed struggle and a political struggle to overturn British imperialism in Kenya. Kimathi was a highly dynamic figure, loved by the people, feared by the imperialists, and was eventually captured by the imperialists and assassinated, as were several other of our figures, of our leaders. But another front on the African revolution was in Algeria, and the Algerian liberation movement was significant, particularly because it spoke to the Arab question in the African revolution, and that's still a question that for the most part has gone unresolved in terms of how our people understand it. Our party has correctly asserted that if Arabs or anybody else in the continent or around the world are going to be part of the African liberation movement, then they're going to have to follow the leadership of the African working class. And especially for Arabs on the continent, they're going to have to struggle in the interests of African people, and not necessarily for some type of neo-colony of Arabs in Africa. And so forces like Ben Bella during this period took one of the most principled stances around that question by aligning himself and Arabs in Algeria and Northern Africa with the African Revolution, and he saw himself as an African. And ALN and the FLN, which were the organization under Ben Bella's leadership, led magnificent struggle to overturn French imperialism, French colonialism in Algeria. One of the most significant figures, and I'm sure we all familiar with Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah, who was a giant in the African liberation movement for a lot of reasons, particularly because of his principled struggle to unite Africa. There's a lot of things that Nkrumah did not understand, but there were key things that he had a very firm grasp on, and which was particularly the question of Africa being united. His goal was to build a United States of Africa under the all-African socialist government. And he understood as well that if Africans are going to be free anywhere, then we're going to have to make one united liberation struggle all over the world, including the fronts that are not on the continent. And Nkrumah's writings inform the party and the ASI and African internationalism to this very day. So Nkrumah was a highly significant figure, and at the height of the Ghana, so-called Ghana Liberation Movement, Ghana was seen and embraced by African revolutionaries around the world as a safe haven, as a mecca, if you will, of revolutionary struggle, where several forces came to study and seek refuge during other times. So ultimately, like other, like all the other fronts of our African revolution, the Ghana front and Nkrumah himself was overcame by the counterinsurgency by the imperialists. Nkrumah ended up being usurped from power. A coup was organized, and he was exiled from Ghana. And several other revolutionaries during this period were assassinated, and including Lumumba, who was also a key force in terms of the struggle to unite Africa. And we learned a lot from this period. And this is important for us to understand as we do our work moving forward.
Okay, bro.
So that was just a taste of the things, the factors that contributed to the deepened crisis that imperialism is undergoing to this very day. And the fact is that imperialism is still trying to recuperate from the struggles that we were making even during that period. And we're going to learn more about how it attempted to recover, although this process is irreversible. But another significant thing about this period is the Second Imperialist War, like we said before. And while we just, you know, saw how our people are struggling and have been struggling for control of our resources and our freedom, on the other side, imperialism, European countries in the U.S. and other imperialist countries had an interest in making sure that our people did not make these struggles. And more than that, to make sure that imperialism remained, had maintained its grip on our resources, and to maintain the system of colonialism, which facilitates the theft of our resources. And so World War II was essentially a war that was being fought amongst imperialist countries to determine which of those countries would control what stolen resources. And, you know, I know that we learned in the history books and when we went to school how World War II was about, you know, Hitler and the Jews and, you know, spreading democracy and all that. But the reality was that World War II was an imperialist war being fought by those same countries to determine who would control what stolen loot. So we can move forward, bro. So, you know, there was several different forces involved in this war, including the U.S., Japan, the so-called allies of France and Britain, and Russia, the Soviet Union was involved, and of course Germany. but ultimately, the conclusion of this war, the results were that Europe and Japan were left devastated for a lot of different reasons because of the war itself, the conditions, and the U.S. Emerged from the Second Imperialist War essentially as the primary or the leadership of white power, as the as they call themselves, the world superpower. And a lot of this had to do with the fact that the ability for Britain and France and other countries to maintain colonial domination over different areas of the world was weakened because of the war. And also the economic state that a lot of these countries were left in enabled for the U.S. to benefit directly from the resources that would have otherwise been going to Britain or going to France, particularly Britain. And so the result being, go ahead, bro, that again, the United States emerges as the leading imperialist power. And in this process, the U.S., go ahead. Actually, go back, pardon me. Yes, sorry. In this process, massive amounts of resources and wealth begin to flow into the U.S. economy. And there's a lot of factors and a lot of reasons why this is significant, many of them actually impacted on the U.S. front of the African Liberation Movement. And we're going to look at how that really panned out in this next phase of the presentation. but essentially, the U.S. emerges as the world leading power, and all types of wealth is in its control. So, go ahead, bro. Yeah. So now, that whole dynamic leaves an entirely different set of contradictions within the U.S. and current U.S. borders in terms of the political economy inside U.S. borders, notwithstanding what's going on in the rest of the world. But many of those conditions lead to the emergence, lead to the emergence of what is known as the Civil Rights Movement.
Thank you, Carl.
The Civil Rights Movement being essentially a movement under the leadership of liberal white power in alliance with the African petty bourgeoisie or the African middle class, both of whom had their own selfish interests, and both of whom had an objective interest in creating what is known as the Civil Rights Movement. And we're going to look at how exactly that looked. So go ahead, bro. Now, during this period, especially with the flow of stolen resources coming into the U.S. economy, we now have a situation where different sectors of the ruling class inside the United States begin to have to grapple with this question of these new resources, and particularly the northern industrial ruling class sees a prime opportunity to gain more wealth and more primacy and dominance in the capitalist system itself through this process, because as we know, and as we will come to know, these resources don't just turn into money for white people. These resources, in order to produce value for the economy and for the ruling class, have to be transformed into commodities and things that will generate the wealth. And in order for them to be transformed into commodities, you need workers. And it has always been the case in the capitalist system, the ruling class, the bourgeoisie, will seek the cheapest labor and the most efficient means of that process. And the historical basis of that relationship has always been with the African working class, African people. As we, you know, from slavery until this very day, it is always the expropriated labor and value from Africa that has created wealth for white power, and nothing, and this is no different. So now, but there is a contradiction within the ruling class, because in the South, you have a labor-intensive economy. Go ahead, bro. You have a labor-intensive economy. We can stop there, actually. A labor-intensive economy that had historically been based and Africans basically working in the fields and working hard under the sun and picking cotton and the rest of that to create value for the southern plantocracy or whatever, you know what I'm saying, the southern ruling class who controlled that sector of the economy. But at the same time, you have other sectors of the ruling class who have an interest and the industrial capital intensive sector of the market, of the economy, which can be found in the factories. And like we said, converting these raw materials coming from colonial territories around the world into materials to be bought and sold. And so, you know, for instance, the bauxite coming from Guinea-Conakry is not really worth anything until it's made into aluminum, you know what I'm saying, in the Alcoa factory in Pittsburgh. And so the liberal northern industrial ruling class saw a great opportunity to increase its wealth in that process in the factories that it owned and controlled, but they needed it for the cheap labor. So this put it at odds with the crackers down south, because the crackers down south had things going pretty good by just having us work in the fields, and the factories wasn't really a factory and all that. So they needed to be a way to free up African workers down south in order to participate in this new economy, you know what I'm saying, in the north. And of course, there was a lot of obstacles in that way, particularly the entire political and social system that existed in the south, Jim Crow, and all types of apartheid-like conditions that existed in the south that made it impossible, highly difficult for African workers to do anything but stay on the fields. So in order for the northern industrialists to get stolen African labor up north, they had to undermine the entire Jim Crow and the apartheid system and the rest of it. And essentially, this was the basis of the northern imperialist, the liberal imperialist campaign for civil rights. And at the same time, there was another factor, which was the African middle class, particularly those were living in the South, who were themselves part of that same colonial apartheid-like social system. And but the middle class, as it has always been, is a social force who whose aspirations is to integrate into the capitalist system to basically achieve equal, if not more rights than white power itself in terms of exploiting and oppressing the masses of African workers. And as we even know to this day, you know what I'm saying, and part of what we are overturning is that situation where an African who may go to these universities and colleges with honest, you know what I'm saying, aspirations just to feed themselves and their family, and come out with an entirely different set of worldview and interests, you know what I'm saying, as a social force. But particularly this social force in this period, you know, a lot of them, the middle class, would go to colleges, Morehouse and Tuskegee and the rest of it. You know what I'm saying? They you know, they had education. They were preachers a lot of times, undertakers and all that. And so, you know, they had to come back to Biloxi, Mississippi, where they may, you know, read better and be more literate and more intelligent and more knowledgeable than the crackers that's running the city. But because, simply because they are Africans and because they are colonial subjects, they have to be subject to that same oppressive conditions. And so the middle class was like, well, damn, I mean, if these white people can run the city, I definitely, you know what I mean, I can run the city. And and so, but the obstacle, of course, was Jim Crow and the apartheid-like system. So the African middle class as well had an interest in the creation of what we know as the civil rights movement, which would enable for the African middle class to have to integrate and participate in the political system and the economic system, you know what I'm saying, to achieve its own selfish class interests. But as we see even to this day, even though we got the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of 65 and all that, little has changed, and if anything, things have gotten worse for the masses of African people, for the African working class. But the Civil Rights Movement solved the problems of both the liberal imperialists of the North as well as the African middle class, particularly in the South. And so this essentially were the conditions that gave birth to the Civil Rights Movement, which, you can go ahead. So, you know, and we're seeing some images of the things we're describing. You know what I'm saying? The middle class is out of any grade. And this right here is an image, actually.
I definitely saw a design on his face.
What's that?
I definitely saw a design.
Yeah. So, yeah, and these are just some of the things. So, and yeah, stop here. So, the civil rights movement, essentially, you know, was a very limited revolution, if you will. And revolution might even not be the right term to use, but it was definitely a movement that had limitations imposed on it by the forces that were leading it. And again, those forces was the liberal imperialists and the African middle class itself. And so this whole question of nonviolence was a strategic component of the civil rights movement. Because again, it was never the intention of either one of those forces to see Africans struggle beyond what it took for them to achieve their own interests. And the question of armed struggle would definitely undermine and allow things to get beyond its own control. And that's not the primary factor, of course, because even during that period, you had forces who united with the question of civil rights and followed the leadership of the civil rights movement and the African middle class, but some of whom thought that it was necessary to carry arms and to actually engage in armed struggle, but not necessarily toward the aim of seizing political power for the African working class or any type of revolutionary process, but basically, as the question, as the chairman say, Jesse Jackson with guns, you know, and that's important for us to understand, because the question of just holding heat is not really the fundamental question. There's nothing necessarily revolutionary about waging armed struggle. It is a question of in whose interests the struggle is being made and what your strategic goals and aims are. And the philosophical worldview that informs the moves that we make, and the middle class, the civil rights movement, the whole philosophical premise of it was a question of racism and getting white people to see us differently, essentially, and which really would end up being a question of Africans changing something about ourselves, as if we are the primary contradiction in this whole thing. So there was all types of philosophical contradictions involved in the civil rights movement that eventually would be revealed, particularly under the leadership of forces like Malcolm X, but other forces as well. But the question of philosophy is extremely important, and we're going to begin to see why that is, especially in this process. So, you know, the nonviolent thing, you know. So, you know, so yeah, so now the African working class begins to split with the African middle class. And this manifested itself in a lot of different ways. And this is significant because, and first of all, it's important when we talk about the party and the history of the party, we have always been clear that we are the advanced detachment of the African working class, and we are biased. And we struggle in the interests of the working class, not in the interests of any other social force, especially the ruling class and the middle class, you know. And the fact is that we have an entirely different set of interests than the middle class do, you know. And Malcolm put it very well with his the example of the house nigga and the field nigga, you know, where, you know, he made it clear that, you know, on the plantation, you got the house nigga, which is usually a minute part of the population, you know what I'm saying? And the house nigga has an entirely different set of material interests than do the field slaves, right? The field workers. And while the field workers is out in the field under the hot sun, catching the lash of the whip, and its only interest, our only interest, is in the destruction of slavery itself and the burning down of the plantation. But the house nigga his interest is in preserving the system of slavery, because that's, you know, how he's eating. That's how, you know, he gets to live in an entirely different reality than the rest of us. So that contradiction begins to be exposed in this process. And again, you have figures like Malcolm, who, you know, was highly significant for that period, that inspired, you know what I'm saying, and sparked the imagination and started to really reveal these contradictions in a real way. And he was a principal force that was unflinching in his criticisms of imperialism and of the neo-colonialism of the middle class. And so, let's go ahead. So, you know, we begin to see different types of dynamics, you know what I'm saying, and contradictions develop in this process, where now, the interests of the African working class begin to surface and make their way up to the agenda of the whole African liberation movement, especially in the U.S. And not all of this was done under the leadership of a conscious force that, you know, kind of saw the whole picture, but these are the subjective conditions that were forcing their way forth. And one of the most significant forces, organizational forces, in that process was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which Comrade Kobina made reference to in his presentation. And the SNCC, you know, even in its name, nonviolent, you can see that it was born out of the middle class led civil rights movement and the whole philosophical assumptions that it rested on. But SNCC was a development in this process because it partly because of its youthful energy, but more than that, because SNCC, its primary task was to actually go out amongst the people, you know what I'm saying, in the most vicious conditions in the South, in the Deep South, and their task was to undermine this apartheid system in the South and the Jim Crow and all that. And in that process, SNCC began to be radicalized in its understanding of what the contradictions were. And Chairman O'Malley was a member of SNCC for one period and actually built the first membership branch of SNCC, and he could, I'm sure, will say some more things about its significance. But in the final analysis, it is our actual struggle to organize the people, you know what I'm saying, and to really put forth the interests of the people, as opposed to some type of commandist or petty bourgeois type leadership that assumes that the organizer knows what the people need to be doing from this distant, remote location. But SNCC actually went down into the community, lived amongst the people, and in that process achieved a deeper understanding of what the real contradictions was all about. So this was part of the, you know what I'm saying, what led to the developments of this new struggle for black power and the African working class and the split away from the middle class. Go ahead.
May I do an intervention now?
Please do.
Can I come up there?
Oh, go ahead.
Uhuru, I just think this is an extremely important discussion in general, but especially when you talk about like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, especially since we're talking about building the student wing of the party, and the need for all of us to understand and for students and young people to understand the role that students and young people played in this whole process, because that's something that's understated and often misstated. It's misstated by a particular group that was born out of the SNCC process in some ways in the form of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, because they initiated this whole politic and this whole line that students are the spark of the revolution, that somehow gave this incredible significance to students, as though students themselves are a social force. And students are not a social force. Students are, we talk about social force, we're talking about a class force. And students are not a social force. Most students aspire to become part of the petty bourgeoisie, et cetera, but they're just students. The students, by definition, is not a social force. And so that was a terrible misstatement of the relationship that students had to the struggle. But the thing is that students were mobilized by the conditions of black people. It wasn't that somebody went on a campus and discovered this tremendous energy and said, hey, let's go out and do such and such a thing. It was the condition of the whole African population that thrust students into motion, the same thing that thrust everybody else into motion. It was just the conditions. And it wasn't as though, particularly during this period of time, that students were able to ignore the reality of the broad mass of African people, because especially prior to things like so-called desegregation, a black worker would not be allowed in certain places and had to sit on the back of the bus, and a black student did too. A black middle-class person did too. So students could not escape the reality of the broad mass of African people. You just being a student didn't mean a damn thing. I don't care what you were studying. If you were in certain parts of this country and you were black, then that meant you had to face the same reality all the time that the rest of the African people faced. And this was something that helped to mobilize students. The condition of Africans mobilized students, not the condition of students mobilized students. And so, given the situation with SNCC in, around 1960, something like that, then you saw the sit-ins that had a new set of sit-ins that had begun by students in Tennessee. Wasn't it Tennessee? Was it Tennessee or Carolina? Tennessee. What was the Woolworth stores? North Carolina. And when they started, this incredible woman, who is the most unsung, under-recognized person in the whole process of revolutionary struggle in this country. Her name was Ella Baker, who was one of the primary organizers of the NAACP. She traveled all over the South organizing the NAACP. Primary organizer of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She traveled all over and didn't like Martin Luther King too much. In fact, in SNCC, they used to call Martin Luther King the Lord. In part because most of them had problems with women's leadership, and Ella was just an incredible woman. But she called this conference, and in this conference, because all the students were doing things, so she called conference with the students, and that's how it came to be a coordinating committee, how to start coordinating all these activities that African students were involved in. And it was she who influenced them not to become like to part of the SCLC or the NAACP, but to go ahead and build their own piece. And so SNCC was born out of that. Now let me tell you something. The thing that was so powerful about SNCC, Comrade Diop was mentioning it, was SNCC's willingness to go into the most difficult circumstances that African people were confronted with and to organize our folk. And it's difficult, it's for you to understand what that means when you live in circumstances where the naked, raw hostility and oppression of white power and white people, in the white power being exercised in the form of individual white people even, or mobs of white people, not just the state like we run into it right now, but when you live in a situation where you know, in my lifetime, right, that if this white man is upset, you know, he can kill us with impunity. He can kill me. He can take my life, and nothing is going to happen to him. That was the reality. And so African people lived in naked terror throughout the South. And you know, when you start talking to about, come on, let's go register to vote, you know, I mean, you're talking to people who are terrorized about what the possibilities, and these are real possibilities. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Martin Luther King's organization, they would come into town. All the media is there with them because King is there. They would hold big rallies in the churches and stuff, raise a lot of money, and they would get out of town. Well, they got out of town. The local white people, you know, did the, you know, really messed over the population. But SNCC went in and stayed in, not with fanfare, et cetera, and lived with the people. under the most grotesquely impoverished, brutal circumstances, SNCC lived with the people and actually would organize people to empower them on some basis where they were located in the form of organizations. SNCC built the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in Mississippi. That the Freedom Summer of 1964. It was a combination of organizations, but SNCC was the primary organization of that. Where Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney were killed in Mississippi, and Cheney, I'm told, beaten so badly that there was hardly that almost every bone in his body was broken. But this was SNCC.
That was part of the presentation on history and of the African People's Socialist Party and history of the African Liberation Movement. We're going to continue with more there. I just want to again, you know, note the significance of this presentation. You know, because for one reason, it's important. It's important. Because, you know, outside of the Uhuru movement, there hadn't really been a real good summation of the Black Power movement of the 60s and what happened, how we got to where we are now, where, you know, you have a situation where all around the world, the African world, you have, as the chairman Amalia Shetela says, like this. This end of history, you know, where you know we have this flag independence, or we have, you know, what they're calling civil rights, and it's like it's looked at as if there's an end. We've arrived, you know. And the problem that we face as African people now is just that we're not making it work. Like it's supposed to work, and of course that's off, you know, because, you know, while, you know, there is a flag independence throughout Africa, it's not any real kind of independence, because we still don't control our own economy. You know, we still don't control our own resources. The economies in throughout the micro states that have been created for imperialism in Africa are controlled by the same imperialist powers who imposed colonialism and slavery on African people. And, you know, in places like the U.S. and the U.K., you know, so-called civil rights mean nothing as African people are gunned down by police. Are locked down in prisons. In the U.S., there are more than a million African people in prison. You know, so it's not that we've arrived. It's not that we have, you know, freedom now, and we're just not making it work. The reality is, the only thing that's changed is the face of colonialism. You know, it's the same situation though. We have neocolonialism. We have white power and blackface, so we're able to we have, you know, these guys who are presidents and prime ministers or senators and you know, advisors to the mayor and you know, things like that, you know, who are Africans, but they don't move in the interest of African people. In fact, they are a comprador class, a trader class, the African petty bourgeoisie, which has aligned its interests with the interests of imperialism, and in effect has stifled the African liberation movement, you know, and so that's what we're facing today. And so it's important for us to understand this history of the African liberation struggle. It's important for us to understand this thing so that we can have a correct summation as we move forward, you know, as we continue to make the struggle. So we don't find ourselves, you know, occupied fighting to make white people like us or fighting to make this silly thing that they're calling independence work, because it can't work. It can't, you know, the situation that we're in cannot work because we still are not a self-determining people. And the only solution for African people is to get back to what we were, to how we were before we came in contact with Europe and European people, to have control over our own resources, to have control over our own lives, to be able to determine for ourselves what will happen with our Africa, what will happen with our children, and what will happen with our future. Wanted to point that out. I also wanted to note that at some point during the presentation that Comrade Diop Olugbala was making, he mentioned Jomo Kenyatta and was raising, saying that Jomo Kenyatta was a mistakenly said that Jomo Kenyatta was, you know, a good force, you know, who you know, had unity with the Mau Mau in Kenya, but that was incorrect, and it was corrected during that process by Chairman Amalia Shetela. Jomo Kenyatta, you know, contrary to popular belief at that time, was nothing more than a neo-colonial force. He was not a force in support of the Mau Mau. He used the motion of the Mau Mau, you know, to get into power, but he's not, you know, he's a neo-colonial force who got rich off of the misery of our people. Subsequently, you know, in becoming president, he you know, the situation for African people in Kenya has gotten only worse, so just wanted to note that. And we're going to take a short break, play a couple promos for you, and we're going to come back with more from the presentation on the history of the African Liberation Movement, of the African People's Socialist Party, that this presentation that happened at the ISO conference on June 21st through the 24th. So we'll take a break and let's come back.
African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela's new book, One Africa, One Nation, is available now. In this historic collection, the chairman and representatives of the emerging African Socialist International explain why Africa and all its resources must be liberated and in the hands of African workers and peasants in Africa and everywhere. The chairman's new book, One Africa, One Nation, documents the process of building the African Socialist International, which is rapidly growing in countries throughout Africa and in the U.S., the Caribbean, and elsewhere around the world. For pictures of the chairman's recent book signing tour, and to order your copy of One Africa, One Nation, go to burningspearuhuru.com. That's www.burningspearuhuru.com.
Shop, donate, and volunteer at Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles for great deals on high-quality used furniture and unique treasures. Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles is a non-profit used furniture and collectible store with outlets in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Oakland, California, and St. Petersburg, Florida. Uhuru Furniture Stores are an institution of the African People's Education and Defense Fund for genuine economic development for the African community. All donations are tax-deductible. Volunteer at Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles to be part of a great community of people who have a true desire to change the conditions of life for the African community. To locate the store nearest you, visit apedf.org and click the Uhuru Furniture link. That's APEDF, the acronym for African People's Education and Defense Fund. Or simply Google Uhuru Furniture.
This is Max Rameau with Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
Oh, this one is for the people. A blood diamond crown.
Cold town.
Big up in here.
This one, definitely for the people.
Yeah. Yeah. Putting it down for the people.
Where that? Rumble.
Where that?
Give it up. We got a room on. Where that?
Where's our diamonds? Natural shining for me. Finding from St. Petersburg. Reparations
to LA.
Our resources
NY.
From our nation. Where's our diamonds?
Brazil, Africa.
Here on Africa Live on UhuruRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've been playing excerpts from a presentation made at the conference to build the African Internationalist Student Organization that happened on June 21st through the 24th. The presentation we've been playing excerpts from was a presentation on the history of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Liberation Movement, a presentation that was led by our comrade Diop Olugbala, the international organizer for NP Dumb. We left off where the chairman, Chairman Amalia Shetela, was making an intervention, and we're going to start back up during that intervention process. We're going to continue with this thing. So listen up and learn about the history of the party and the African Liberation Movement.
Could see their fate as part of the same fate as the rest of the African population. Now it's a little more complicated with that, with the civil rights victory, with so-called civil rights. Now students aspire, you know, because it's legal now, and most of the legal and traditional barriers don't exist about working for a big-time corporation,
are running to be the next Negro this or the Negro that. So students sometimes forget that as an African people, their fate is tied to the masses of the people who live out there in the ghettos and all this other kind of stuff. And so that complicates it a little bit, which is part of what our task is, and the task of the student wing of the party is to help people understand, to give people an understanding that even though it is not immediately visible to you, because they say you can do this or you can do that, but the fate of the Africans, our fate is connected together, whether we're on campus, off campus, whether we're in Jamaica, the United States, or Africa, or Europe, right? We got the same fate. That's part of the task that the student wing will have to assume. And I just want to say that in many ways, the struggle in Africa and the U.S. and other places is the same. I mean, we did a lot of discussion you saw here about Africa. We saw a lot of stuff about Africa. But in many ways, it's the same. And by that, I mean that in Africa and the U.S. and even in the Caribbean and other places, the struggle led by the African middle class was a struggle somehow to find a way to integrate more or less into the existing system. Even if you were in Trinidad or Jamaica, even if you got your own Negro constitution, it was a constitution that allowed you to do more or less the same thing that the white folks could do when they ran Jamaica, when they ran Trinidad, or when they ran Ghana, you know, et cetera. So it was like a struggle more that was designed more or less to integrate into the existing system, just like in this country, the struggle led by the African middle class was a struggle to integrate into the existing system. It wasn't a struggle to overturn our relationships to the system and to found and create, you know, like our own self-serving kind of system. Also, I just wanted to say that the primary sector of the middle class that we discussed here was what we sometimes refer to as the liberal sector of the middle class. It is a sector of the middle class that was aligned with the liberal sector of the white ruling class. We have to recognize that the white ruling class is not a homogeneous entity. It is not an entity. They've got different interests. Some of their livelihoods are tied to different sectors of the economy. Some people are like heavily, like right now, you can see the oil industry and people tied to the arms industry and stuff like that. They are all for the war, et cetera. But there are other sectors of the economy who are hurt by this, and these are ruling class elements as well, and so they are in contention. They don't want to overthrow them. They don't want to overthrow the whole system, right? They want to try to find a way to moderate this thing so that they can get their peace and the others can get their peace as well. In our communities and throughout the African world, you've had this sector that's tied to the liberal imperialism, whether it was here or in Africa, or whether it was in the Caribbean or other places. But there's also been another sector of the middle class that was disdainful of the white liberals and of the setup that existed and wasn't trying to integrate into it, but wanted to replace the white rulers with their black selves. Not to overturn the system, but to replace the white rulers with themselves. And so some of them were people who also called for black power. The Congress of Racial Equality came out for black power under Floyd McKissick. And in one of the Carolinas, they set up what they call Soul City, working closely with Richard Milhouse Nixon, who was then the president, who called for the creation of black capitalism. So the thing is, they had the ability to be pro-black and for black and all of that, but that's because, and they were anti-white. And to the extent that they were in contention with this other white forces. The original Nation of Islam was like that in this regard, because it was an organization of petty merchants. Petty, you know, this whole thing was to create its own peace, do for self, have our own peace under this theocracy, if you will. It was not something that promoted the emancipation of the broad masses of people who were thereby being empowered, you see? And so I think I just wanted to pass that on to you. And sometimes we articulate when we think we're being super black,
when we start talking about my king, my queen, this is my queen, etc., you know what we've actually done is we've introduced into, conceptually, into our own movement, the idea of this superior entity that exploits masses of people. A king and a queen is an exploiter. Our objective is to overturn the kings and the queens of the world, not to become the kings and queens of the world. You know, so I wanted to say that. And finally, I wanted to mention, we're using words like imperialism, but imperialism is a term that comes from the word empire. It's a term that comes from the word empire. And of course, an empire is where a particular state has the ability to live off the resources of other peoples and other countries and what have you. And that's the empire. And Europe is rife with the history of empires, the Roman Empire. That's why, notwithstanding what they say, it's hard for Europeans to be anti-imperialist. Because the greatest, most glorious times in their history was times of empire. So you hear, you know, you go to the history and they wax nostalgic about the days of the Roman Empire, the British Empire, you know, all of this kind of stuff of empire. But what empire was, an instance where people are living off other people. And you know, if you read them and when they talk about it, they say things like, what happened to the Roman Empire? Anybody, quickly, what did they say? What's the explanation? What happened to the Roman Empire? Yes, what?
It was too large, they could no longer control.
Okay, that might be something. What else is said about the Roman Empire?
Corruption.
Decadence. You know, destroyed the Roman Empire. There's nothing like the Roman Empire was destroyed and should have been destroyed because it lived off other people. Because it was taking the resources of other people and feeding the Romans, right, and et cetera. So it was all this other kind of stuff. And so in order not to be like Rome, it's not that you don't exploit and go out other people. You just don't do the kinds of things that you don't be decadent and you don't, you know, be corrupt and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So that's increasingly you hear the imperialists of the day talk about empire. So there's more to the discussion about imperialism, but that's the origin of the term imperialism, because we throw it out, you know, but it comes from this whole concept of empire. The term does. And I think it's important when we get into these discussions to say, because sometimes people's understanding, all the time, people's understanding is connected to the amount of information, you know, that we have. And it's really important for us to be able to say that the problem that we're trying to solve is about 500 years old, the immediate problem, something like that. Because the last 500 years or so has been the history of imperialism, of empire, of white folk leaving Europe and then doing terrible things to everybody else. I was looking at a newspaper article today or yesterday, an article anyway, that talk about the first evidence of a gunshot victim that they found in America, in the Americas, was an Inca Indian who was killed in 1500 and something, right? 1500 by a Spaniard who had been shot in the head. And, you know, they found the history, according to Spain, of how the fight that happened, et cetera, et cetera. But so you go back, the first gunshot wound that they've got a history of in the Americas, 15-something, by white folk who came from Spain, came all the way from Spain to kill an Indian in the Americas. And that's the history that we've been overcoming. So for the last 500 years, we've had this abnormal situation where Europeans have dominated everybody on earth, not just black people here in this country as we've been led to believe. Our solution is not a new African five-state stuff, you understand? Five states on the Indian land, that's not the solution. It's 500 years. Our solution is not to integrate into criminal enterprise. As Malcolm X said, who wants to integrate into a burning house, right? But to look at this whole thing and to see that it's not something that's just particular and peculiar to us here, but it's peculiar to us as a people all over the world. And guess what? We got something in common with everybody else in the world who suffered from the same kind of 500-year history. So up until the Second Imperialist War, that they call World War II, that Diop was talking about, England alone controlled one quarter of the entire world's population and one quarter of the entire world's people. And that's not something that England is ashamed of. I mean, this is something you think, you know, for all this time, we've dominated all these people, taken all their resources, lived off them, fed our babies at their expense, and now even everywhere you look in the world, people are still suffering from it, and therefore, you know, woe is us, how terrible we have been. It's not something that England is ashamed of, nor the entire white world, and unfortunately, too much of the whole planet Earth, including other peoples, are not bothered by that. It's almost like a rite of passage that humanity had to go through. So somehow, you know, you were a slave, now you're not a slave, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's treated in that fashion, like what do you call it when something was predestined? You know, this just happens, that's just the way it happens. It was, et cetera. But that ain't the way it happens. And so what we're talking about, you know, we talk about desegregation and desegregation, and we talk about Jim Crow and independence, et cetera. All this discussion is about trying to rectify this relationship that we have with this imperial order that has been imposed on us, and every device that's imaginable has been used to maintain it. So, and then Samora is Michelle, not Michelle. And Jomo Kenyatta was not a supporter of Mau Mau. He was coy enough to be able to use it to threaten the white people, you know, but he was not a supporter of Mau Mau, and he was an opponent of Mau Mau, and in fact, but we didn't know that. Everybody thought it was Jomo Kenyatta. That's why we are the Burning Spear. That's why we created an organization, Hunter Militant Organizations, Jomo, because everybody thought it was Jomo Kenyatta. And Jomo Kenyatta, of course, he was a Pan-Africanist. He was in the same movements as Nkrumah and Du Bois and all those other people when they were traveling to London, et cetera. But he was an opponent of it. And even subsequent to him going to power, where now his family is filthy rich, stinking rich, in the middle of the misery of the masses of people in Kenya, the workers, what's this man named? Ngugi wa Thiong'o, is that his name? The writer. Out of Kenya. Say it.
I don't know his last name, but the one who wrote
Rain of Wheat. Yes. Well, he was working with a group of other intellectuals in Kenya. They organized the peasants to build a theater, outdoor theater, and they wrote a play about the struggle against Mau Mau, against the British Mau Mau. And many of these were former Mau Mau, because they were peasants. That was a peasants uprising that was based essentially among Kikuyu ethnic group. And Kenyatta's military force came in, destroyed it, wiped it out, beat their asses and things like that. And it wasn't even a criticism of Kenyatta, it was a criticism of what the British had done. And of course, he was in exile for a long time, this man I'm talking about. And a couple of years ago, when he went back to Kenya, they raped his wife. It was obviously a political, you know, thing. They, you know, raped his wife. So it's a filthy regime, and Kenyatta was a filthy. He was a Jesse Jackson of his time. These were people who, you know, could manipulate. They knew enough how to manipulate the colonial systems and stuff like that. He went to jail because the system was intolerant of any kind of opposition. You didn't have to be a rebel. You didn't have to be Dedan Kimathi. But when the crisis emerged and Dedan Kimathi and the Kenyan Land Freedom Army began wiping everything out, and it became time for them, the British, to try to, after they were able, they killed thousands and thousands and thousands of Kikuyu, and after they and stuck them in concentration camps all over Kenya, and then after
they had defeated the insurgency, they went to prison and took Kenyatta out, and then they had this, you know, constitutional writing and everything, and he became the first president. So, yeah.
Since we raised the whole issue of Jomo Kenyatta, another person that's often raised up, especially in Pan-African circles, mm-hmm. is Julius Nyerere. So I was wondering.
Nyerere was an interesting liberal. Nothing revolutionary about Nyerere, but he was a liberal and somewhat supportive, but he fought Nkrumah on the critical question. And the critical question was the idea of the United States of Africa, and all kinds of forces fought Nkrumah. And they used different methods and arguments against it. And Nyerere's argument was that you can't have it like that, and he believed in quote-unquote regional Pan-Africanism. So you build these regional blocks. You know, Tanzania as itself came into existence as a consequence of what at least has been a temporary union of Tanganyika and the island of Zanzibar. And there's still a whole bunch of friction, you know, there, and constant threats to by Zanzibar to separate from the mainland, etc. But Nyerere was a liberal. And, you know, until he died, I mean, there were a lot of Africans from here went to Tanzania and worked on his, and they had a lot of freedom to do stuff, you know, in Tanzania. And Tanzania was one of the frontline states in the struggle against apartheid, you know, happened. People were able to go and find bases, and they had political support and stuff like that. So to that extent, Nyerere, you know, was a progressive. He was a progressive liberal. He was like a social democrat. This is essentially what Nyerere was, like a social democrat. I call it frontline state, but actually Tanzania was not a frontline state, but it was a place where folk were able to, militants were able to base, revolutionaries were able to base themselves and get support, you know, et cetera. So.
Chairman.
Yes,
ma'am. I have two questions. One is, so in Kenya, who was like the most progressive force on the ground that, you know, how did it achieve internal independence?
It didn't. The most progressive force on the ground was the Kenyan Land Freedom Army, Mau Mau. And that struck terror into the hearts of the white folk there and everywhere. You should have seen the kind of slander that would come out against Mau Mau. You know, that was before you had like a CNN kind of situation, even before much television existed. But in the movies, they would show these news clippings and briefs, and they'd show you, you know, like the struggle of the British against the, you know, the Mau Mau and the Mau Mau with these, you know, violent things. And then there's a book I have about a forgotten. The title makes the assumption of a stupid black people who are being led by cunning communists and stuff like that. So all kind of implicit stuff was on about them, but it was the Kenyan Land Freedom Army, Mau Mau. And the Mau Mau, one of the things that they used against Mau Mau to say how the Mau Mau was not for African people was because the Mau Mau, one of the primary target of Mau Mau was sellouts.
Yes.
Was a sellout among themselves. And so they were icing people, you know, they made it really uncomfortable to be somebody who was selling out the people. And the British literally did hundreds of thousands of, they targeted the Kikuyu. They did things like, you know, create huge concentration camps to try to cordon them off and to, you know, keep the revolution from happening there, similar to what they did in Vietnam and in other places where they do counterinsurgency struggle. The British were expressly vicious. They did things like they would capture women, and they would use like banana leaves and stick banana leaves in women's vaginas and stick snakes and vermins in women's vaginas and in men's anuses. This is what the British did. This was not, you know, like, you know, like Abu Ghraib. You know, none of that stuff is a fluke and accident. They did this as a matter of policy. And they executed, you know, and they just would go and pick up somebody and say, we want you to tell us what you know. They would just pick up any Kikuyu And because the Mau Mau Uving is was something that was kind of typical of a Kikuyu culture, you know, where people do oaths. And the Mau Mau, you had to do an oath. And so nobody was telling. And that was a real problem for the British because they had taken an oath. And so the British were just extremely brutal. And they pick up anybody, just anybody, just an African, especially Kikuyu, pick them up and take them someplace and torture them and do some of the things that I just mentioned and even worse things to them. Sometimes just kill them, you know. They were none of this stuff. And none of this stuff is, not much of this stuff is common knowledge. None of it is taught in our universities, our schools. You don't go to any school anywhere where you learn this kind of stuff. I'm talking about the British now, but I'm talking about even stuff white folks did here. You see all this revisionist history. You see, you know, you go to a movie, you see Samuel Jackson, where white people raped his daughter. He goes and kills the white people, and some of the white people are upset, but he's got a good white lawyer. And you know, this ridiculous stuff, because every Negro in that city would have been killed, the whole African population would have been run out of there if he'd killed that white man. I'm telling you the terror that I've known, that Africans have experienced here, and that you have this whole revisionism now. Yeah. So that they whitewash it and think, you know, so, and then you got the good white guy all the time. Blood Diamonds is about white people. Did you see the movie Blood Diamonds?
Yes.
You know, with all the Africans who are dying in the diamond, it's about white people. It's not even about Africans. And there's a movie that's out that I was just looking at the other day, but supposedly a Nama, somebody from the Nama ethnic group in Namibia, who began killing the white explorers and farmers there. It's about white people, even though it's supposed to be about this guy. His name doesn't even appear in the credits and what have you. I mean, so there's a whole historical kind of revisionism, and people are writing out history to fit their political needs and objectives. And that's, of course, Stokely Carmichael there, who became a really important figure in SNCC in 1966. He was always a courageous young man in SNCC, but there were other people in SNCC named James Foreman, who was really a key force, and in many ways, Bob Moses, you know, who was a philosophical, nonviolent, almost mystically tied to philosophical nonviolence, who ended up going to Tanzania and staying for a long time and came back, and now he teaches algebra as some kind of way to free people in this country. And Foreman is the guy who tried to bring together unite the Black Panther Party and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who was quite a force and wrote one of the best books you will ever read on the Civil Rights Movement called The Making of a Black Revolution. You should read it if you haven't.
So that's SNCC. Radicalization of SNCC. So yeah, the chairman, I thank you for that intervention. So in this period, we begin to see, you know, the emergence of the Black Power movement. You know, SNCC's developments, the changes that SNCC was undergoing was just one component of that. But again, it was the conditions that African workers were facing that ultimately led to the emergence of the Black Power movement. And when we say Black Power, we're talking about, you know, real political and economic power in the hands of African workers. And this was a movement that particularly developed within the U.S. borders, you know. So go ahead, bro. So we view the Watts Rebellion of 65 as perhaps the line of demarcation in terms of historical events that had transpired. And the Watts Rebellion was significant because it was one of the first major historical events in which we saw African workers turn our backs on the middle class leadership. And as we know, the Watts Rebellion was sparked by a police murder, as are many rebellions in this country and around the world. Go ahead, bro. But what made the Watts Rebellions significant was, again,
that neo-colonialism or the middle class was rejected. And most of us, you know, if we living in the world today, we know that the traditional response that imperialism has to mass rebellion is the neo-colonial strategy, at least in this last 50-some-odd years. When the people rise up, they send, you know, the Uncle Tom preacher, the Uncle Tom politician, the NAACP representative to calm the masses down. Let's all pray about it, you know, and the rest of it. And that's been a traditional strategy and response. But the Watts Rebellion was significant because even as the imperialists sent in forces like Dick Gregory, who was a liberal, a middle class, a comedian in that day, and he's still running around making speeches today. But you know, during that period, you know, he was you know, an entertainer, but also involved in political life, and he had a middle class line, and he came out to try to calm the masses down, and subsequently he ended up getting shot by the masses. Literally, he was shot. And not just that, but then the imperialists sent in King to try to calm the people down. And although King was not shot by the Africans, he was booed off the stage because we had come to a place where we were no longer trying to hear that, you know, let's be calm, nonviolent type of message. The people were rapidly coming to different, more advanced conclusions about what it's going to take to end the colonial terror we was experiencing. So the Watts Rebellion was significant for that reason. Go ahead, Kobina. So we begin to hear the demand for black power coming out of the community. And there's actually a comrade, a one-time member of our party and a strong supporter of our movement, Willie Mukasa Ricks, who the chairman has worked with in the past, was a member of SNCC also. Willie has been credited with coining the term black power, you know. But when he did, the term caught like wildfire, and it spread rapidly throughout the communities. And the new demand had been about black power. And that's notwithstanding the ideological limitations that we as a people had in terms of what it's going to take to achieve black power or what black power really means in the final analysis. But we was clear on certain things. And we was clear that the colonial relationship that exists between the African workers and white power has to come to an end. And if we didn't know anything else, we knew that's what black power meant. And so that had become the new demand, and that was just a part of the new form of motion that we found the African working class involved in during that period. Go ahead, Kobina. And so the black power movement, and this is the sad thing that it's important to understand, but the black power movement and the African working class as a whole historically in this country has been the most consistently revolutionary population in this country. Every significant social transformation that this country has undergone came about as a consequence of the struggle of African people for our liberation, you know, whether it be the so-called Civil War and Reconstruction and other social transformations that the United States has undergone at its basis had really the question of the resistance of African people and the question of how to contain and maintain the oppression of our people. But at the same time, stay there, please. At the same time, our revolutionary struggle and our historical relationship to white power has also allowed for the African working class to influence other liberation struggles, especially in this country, but in other parts of the world as well. That's a scientifically correct statement. Because again, this social system rests on the African colony. And so it goes without saying that other liberation struggles will be influenced by the struggles that we are making, because our struggles have such impact on the social system. And so some of those examples we saw on the last slide, the brown berets, the essentially what was objectively a part of the struggle for Mexican liberation, although that struggle is to this day coming to new conclusions and changing its own consciousness. But these struggles are always about national liberation, and the brown berets were the Mexican counterpart of the Black Panther Party, if you will, in terms of the type of struggle they were trying to make on the ground. And there are comrades that our party and the organization that our party has a strong fraternal relationship to this day, and the former Unión del Barrio, who came up out of that period as well. Okay, bro. And again, we have even the Indian or the Indigenous People's Liberation Struggle, which has its own limitations, but has always been a legitimate liberation struggle, and which was influenced by the Black Power movement of the 1960s. Yes.
I just want to say, this is kind of an aside, but and I don't have, this is anecdotal. I don't have any evidence that I can show to in terms of data stats, but the thing that I'm really impressed by right now is the growing energy inside the Mexican community, a growing political energy, militancy, grasping toward revolution more than any other community, including the African community that I can see at this moment, which is startling. I mean, so it's part of it, I think, is due to the growing numbers of Mexicans in this who are coming to this country or in the country today as a population force, and also because in many ways all the Mexicans catch hell. You know, Mexicans, you know, the illegals are treated badly, etc. And so the Mexican bourgeoisie, which is probably right now the most leading force of this population, you know, is able to mobilize this force. And the thing about it is that the Mexicans have to fight not only against white power, but they have to fight against the Negro middle class, and then also African, ordinary African folk who see them as interlopers out to take our jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So it's growing an interesting kind of militancy that's also informed partially by the fact that Mexicans, a lot of Mexicans coming across this border are becoming a part of that thing too. So you don't have the same kind of Americanized Mexicans totally, so I just think it's something that is worth noting, that there is a growing, this is anecdotal, like I said, you know, but my experiences are, and everywhere, whether it's on the campuses I've spoken to, in communities, etc., and especially it's interesting among Mexican students, and also Mexican professors. I'm running into this, a lot of radical, you know, and revolutionary consciousness. So this is going to be quite different going around this time, you know, into motion. And I think a much greater capacity on one hand for alliances, but also a lot of potential for terrible contradictions, because there's a lot of violence that's happened between Africans and Mexicans in the barrios and ghettos throughout the West Coast, and in the prisons, Africans and Mexicans are killing each other in terrible kind of competition, etc. But I just wanted to make mention of that since you were talking about berets, because you're right, our movement influenced and our movement continues to influence how they understand and see the world, in some ways, how they organize and struggle.
Yeah.
Particularly the party does.
So that's the some of the influences that the Black Power movement has had on national liberation struggles. And I think, you know, it's important to say as well that the party, we are internationalists, you know. And, you know, as the chairman said, you know, there's great potential for strengthened alliances and, you know, real cooperation amongst you know, other amongst all oppressed people. And the violence that the chairman was referring to that is existing between, you know, poor and exploited African workers and Mexican workers is, like you said, the consequence of the middle class's leadership, you know, and us not even knowing what our real interest is, you know, because, you know, Mexico, California and all that, that belongs to the Mexican people as Africa belongs to us. And neither one of us should be fighting each other for the stolen wealth, you know what I'm saying, that we both have been robbed of. So, you know, and I think that, yeah, I mean, I haven't been over there in a while, but I think that there's great potential. And you know, we have working relationships with, you know, the advanced detachment of especially the Mexican people. And, yeah, we got to deepen that. And we have to keep that in mind, you know. So let's go ahead. Also, back one. This period as well had an influence on the white North American population. And this is a different type of contradiction because as you know, the chairman explained, all Africans and all Mexicans and other oppressed people belong collectively to an oppressed nation. White workers are part of the oppressor nation, and their relationship to oppressed people is a colonial relationship, objectively. And this has played probably the primary role in terms of how white people have related to our movements. And while they have been influenced by the Black Power movement, it has not necessarily, during this period at least, not necessarily served the interests of the struggle to overturn imperialism or to liberate Africa, but instead had served to strengthen the movements that exist within the oppressor nation of white people, where, you know, they may be white workers who are exploited at the factories and white women who can't get a job, period, and gay people who got to worry about whatever, whatever. And all types of contradictions that exist within the oppressor nation, but all of it rests on the pedestal of African oppression and other people's oppression. And because of this, but at the same time, the African Liberation Movement, the Black Power Movement, has weakened the ruling class's ability to control any of this. And so the white North American population has opportunistically sought out its own interests because of the weakened state of imperialism as a whole. And while we were rebelling and burning cities down, this allowed for space for the white women's movement and the gay movement and the white workers' movements to achieve their own selfish interests, but at the expense of the legitimate national liberation struggles that gave them that ability in the first place. And that's important for us to understand because the party under the chairman's leadership has actually been able to solve the problem of white North American opportunism and been able to win those honest forces that may exist within the white North American population to solidarity with our movement, under our movement's leadership. And that will serve to be, and we'll study more about that in this presentation, but that's going to be an important thing to understand. And of course, the peace movement that we're seeing, you know, happening right now, and, you know, we see the picture of the white girl trying to give a flower to the soldier. But the peace movement is probably one of the primary examples of white North American opportunism because, as it was during the Vietnam War, and it is today, the peace movement has never been a question of end the war in Iraq and liberation to the Iraqi people and self-determination to the Iraqi people. They just say, bring the troops home so that my cousin or my brother doesn't have to end up coming home in a body bag. But it's not addressing the real question of how the Iraqi people going to live if these white people is living off of the oil that should belong to the Iraqi people. You know, if it's not addressing the real question of the war that exists, you know what I mean, the war that's being made against oppressed people, whether there's your brother's going to be there as a soldier or not. That was another form of the North American opportunism that reared its head during that period and used the Black Power movement as a pedestal upon which it put forth its own agenda, you know, opportunistically so. So anyway, those are some things kind of like on the side, but important to understand. During this period as well, we see organizational capacity developing in the Black Power movement as well. And part of our understanding as a movement, as a party, is that it ain't going to be no revolution without a revolutionary organization. It's never been in history, and it won't be. And we're clear on that. That's a scientific certainty. And part of the contradiction we was confronted with during the 60s was organizational weakness, and primarily ideological weakness. But we do see signs and developments, organizational development occurring within our movement during the 60s. There was a lot of factors that contributed, one of the most being, the most significant being the masses, the struggle that the masses of our people were making, whether organizations got our shit together or not. And quiet as it's kept, many of the rebellions that occurred during that period happened spontaneously and without, in the absence of organization, so to speak, but only because of the conditions that we was confronted with, and also because of the influence of different things going on in other parts of the country and the world. Organization was not necessarily a precondition for rebellions and for the mass struggle, but at the same time, these are the masses, the struggle of our masses, had, and as it does now, it forces advanced detachments and other forces who may not necessarily be honest to consolidate organization to take advantage or to capitalize off of the struggle that the masses is making. But the primary thing to understand is that is the struggle of the people. In the final analysis, the people are the makers and shapers of history. During this period, because of that influence of the masses, the chairman spoke of with SNCC in particular, we saw in, was it 69, the Democratic Convention with SNCC when SNCC broke away?
No, 64.
1964, a historical event occurred as well where SNCC split from the Democratic Party primarily because of its stance on colonial violence that had been inflicted, that was being inflicted on African people during that period. And we know the sister comrade, Fannie Lou Hamer, extremely important force who led, you know, she was a sharecropper herself, represented the vast, the masses of African workers at that time in terms of her experience and, you know, what she meant to the movement. And she, you know, made the famous quote of, you know, we didn't come on this way for just, you know, two seats, you know. And basically, SNCC split from the Democratic Party. And this is just part of its own radicalization, but which was had at its base and its real motivation was the struggle of the masses and the conditions that all of us was facing in that period. So, go ahead, Snap. So also in that period, we begin to see probably, you know, definitely a qualitative development in terms of our own organizational capacity in the form of the Black Panther Party for self-defense, which actually was influenced by Malcolm's philosophy, but also the struggle that was going on in the South, and even the logo itself, the Black Panther, was first adopted by the Lowndes County Freedom Party in Lowndes County, Alabama, which actually as an organization had adopted as a policy holding arms and propagated armed struggle, and as the chairman may speak on, but again, it's important to understand that the conditions that led to these conclusions where Africans in the South in particular was facing the worst kinds of colonial violence and terror, and the question of holding arms and actually defending ourselves through our armed struggle was a conclusion that came out of the objective conditions and to our existence. So that's important to understand. And so that, along with, again, what Malcolm was teaching, and Malcolm, you know, if we haven't spoken on it yet, was extremely important, part of because he represented a new tendency in an entire generation of African workers in the northern industrial cities who had experienced, you know, all the bullshit that, you know, the northern cities has to offer, contrary to what liberal imperialism had offered up as the promised land and more jobs and you don't got to get lynched up north. Forces like Malcolm represented an entire generation of young African workers who had been there, done that, and lived through the contradictions in the northern industrial cities. And he was able to reveal the liberal imperialists as the same thing, as the other side of the coin, as the southern so-called plantocracy or whatever. And he actually, you know, coined the term the Dixiecrat, referring to the northern Democrats and the southern ones. And basically, they, one may be a fox, one may be a hound, but they both canines. And that was the understanding that Malcolm had brought forth and influenced an entire generation of young African workers, you know. And one of those was Huey P. Newton in Oakland, California, who originally was from Louisiana, but in Oakland, California, you know, observing and reading about the struggle being made and led by Malcolm and other forces, took on the Black Panther logo and got together with six or seven other comrades and formed the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And was it 66. And the Black Panther Party slide was significant for a lot of different reasons, some of which were similar to the significance of SNCC itself and other organizations we're going to learn about. The Panthers was on the ground in the community, serving the interests of the masses, of the people. But the Panthers was significant because it, for one, had been recognized by a movement as a whole as the revolutionary center. Not to say there wasn't other revolutionary organizations on the ground, but the Panthers had achieved probably the greatest organizational capacity. They had chapters, official chapters, all over the U.S. and some in other countries. And they also were clear on their anti-colonialist politic. You know, they were able to articulate what exactly they stood against in terms of colonialism and foreign domination. They had, you know, the 10-point platform, which was, they had a materialist analysis. You know, they, among others, really began to grapple with the question of philosophy and dialectics and materialism in a conscious fashion that our movement had not had the luxury and the opportunity to really do prior to. You know, they were internationalists. Huey Newton once made a statement to the press that the Black Panther Party is going to send forces to Vietnam to fight on alongside Vietnamese armed workers in that struggle. So, you know, that was internationalism to the core, you know, and that's part of why the Panthers was so significant. It had its limitations, but those are some of the strengths, you know. And I want to just make a note that, you know, a lot of times we see the Panthers, we see Huey with the shotgun and, you know, with they holding guns in the capital of California. And that was important as well. But, you know, the most dangerous weapon that the Panthers held was its politic and its ability to expose the contradiction, the colonial contradiction in the community. And things like the survival programs, feeding African youth, free breakfast and health care and the school program, you know, that's what really undermined imperialism's ability to dominate our people. So that's important to understand.
Uhuru, that is that was part of the presentation on the history of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Liberation Movement. That section dealt a lot more with giving a context for the history of the African People's Socialist Party. And we're going to play the rest of that. We're going to play the rest of that presentation because I think it's a very significant presentation. It's significant for those of us who are members of the African People's Socialist Party, but also for those of you who are listeners of Uhuru Radio and supporters of the Uhuru movement, which is all created by the African People's Socialist Party. You know, it's important for you all to understand who the African People's Socialist Party is. And you know, what it is that you are supporting. You know, I want to express appreciation to all of you all who've been listening today to Africa Live and to Uhuru Radio in general. And we're gonna continue this not next week, but the week after. Next week we're gonna have a interview with a brother in Zimbabwe by the name of Kwanisai Mafa, who is part of Zimbabwe youth movement and the Ujamaa farming project. So we're going to do that interview on tomorrow. And on next broadcast, which is next Sunday. And continue with the history of the African People's Socialist Party on the following week. Stay tuned, though, for the rest of today's programming. Next up, you got Uhuru on the Move with MPDUM President Chimurenga Waller and membership coordinator of MPDUM, Brother Kobina Bantu Shango. Uhuru and One Africa, One Nation. Africa, await the creators. Africa, await the creators. Africa, your life was fire upon a stone. Unite for the Africans, unite.
So many things has held us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting our show together, we're polishing up our act. And if you've ever been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down anymore.
Don't you let nothing, nothing stand in your way. I want you to listen, listen
to every word I say, every word I say. Trying to make it, they only push you aside. They really don't have no.